Remembering someone's life at a funeral or a memorial service can bring out warm memories. He knew how to tell a good joke. She didn't have a bad bone in her body. But what do you say when there isn't very much nice to say, when everybody knows he or she was an insufferable tyrant, a selfish curmudgeon, or just plain mean? If you struggled with something to say about the not-so-dearly departed, give us a call. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. The email address is talk@npr.org, or you can join the discussion on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. And this is something that Anne Rowe struggles with on a regular basis. She's the obituaries editor for The Economist magazine, and last week wrote the obit for the so-called Queen of Mean, Leona Helmsley. Anne Rowe joins us from the studios at The Economist in London, and thanks for being with us today on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you, Neil. Good afternoon.
And I have to say, you arrived at an elegant solution to this most recent dilemma. You wrote a double obit of two very rich and very different New York women, Leona Helmsley and Brooke Astor.
That's right, it was pretty irresistible to put the two of them together. But as I said in the obit, one of them was a saint. Brooke Astor was seen as a saint around New York for her humility and graciousness and rather lordly but kind way of giving out money, whereas Leona was seen as a tyrant and a sinner. And you're right, it's pretty hard to write fairly about someone like that.
Mm-hmm. Here's what you quoted them as saying. The arrogance of big money, Mrs. Astor wrote once, is one of the most unappealing of characteristics. Mrs. Helmsley, though fun to her friends, was arrogance personified. Rhymes with rich was Newsweek's caption for her portrait on its cover. We don't pay taxes, she was said to have told a housekeeper once. Only the little people pay taxes.
Yeah, it's great stuff, isn't it? And I think in a way she'd like to have been remembered for those kinds of remarks, so I didn't feel any compunction about putting them in.
Though you did go out of your way to say, though fun to her friends.
Yes, I did want to put that in, because otherwise it's risking falling over into making her a caricature. I feel she did have friends. She wasn't an entirely nasty woman. She gave a lot of money away. Besides Mrs. Astor, she doesn't look too great. But on the other hand, if people do have friends, if people have what seemed to be a happy marriage, if a rather extraordinary one, then you should treat them with a bit of kindness yourself. Mm. I said plenty that was quite hard about her, and I just feel I should leaven these things a little. If she had ever written an autobiography, I would like to have read it, and I would have put in more about her childhood and her feelings as she was growing up, her feelings about her money and so on. I always like to read autobiographies, and I did read Brooke Astor's, and was sorry in the end that because I put two people together, I couldn't leave enough room for much that Brooke said that was fascinating. But I always feel, get inside the heads of these people, try and see the world as they see it, and don't be too judgmental. On the other hand, don't pull any punches.
Yes, you are writing for a journalistic enterprise, and you have to say what needs to be said.
It's true.
You've written obituaries of people as unappetizing as, for example, Saddam Hussein or Mr. Milosevic.
Yes, and there I think you can be as nasty as you like, because there's not a great deal to recommend them. But on the other hand, if you find some little incident in their lives that shows them in a different light, then I think it's very interesting to put it in and make people think a little, so that we're not just exercising our prejudices when we read an obituary. We're thinking a little about that person.
As someone who has, I guess, quite literally the last word, do you ever get to receive fire yourself from, friends, family members, supporters of somebody you've written about who think you've been unfair?
Oddly enough, it's very rare that that happens. It's just happened once or twice. I mean, generally, I've had letters saying that people have liked it, although I never do actually call the family or the friends. Instead, I go back to the person themselves, and I read what they've written, or I read interviews they've given. I don't consult the family, because the family do want hagiography. They do want a eulogy, as you put it. They don't want an obituary. And I'm never prepared to give that. I've always got to leave a little bit of room to put the knife in if I need to.
We're going to leave you a little room to put in the knife if you would like. Give us a call. Have you ever had to eulogize or remember a person who had less than sterling qualities all the time? 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. And we're talking with Anne Rowe, who's the obituaries editor for The Economist magazine. Joining us on the line from Owington, Kentucky, is it Bob?
No, it's Bill.
Bill, excuse me. I couldn't read that line there.
Yes. I serve a Christian Church Disciples of Christ congregation in Kentucky. And several years ago in Louisville, I was asked to do a funeral for a man's mother. And he asked me not to say more than 3 minutes at her service. He hated her. I spent quite a bit of time talking with her neighbors, trying to find any friends that she had. There was not one good thing anyone had to say about this woman. And I was stuck. But I finally found something to say. The only people present at this funeral was this man and his wife. Their two children were not even allowed to be there, myself and the funeral director. And I just went through when she was born, when she died, and I said, whatever this woman has done in this life that you're unhappy about, there is something good. She gave life to you, and you gave life to your two kids. And that was all said within 3 minutes.
I think that's very well done, Bill, I must say. Human beings are always more complex than we give them credit for. There's so many good and bad sides in people. And I think it's the duty of somebody who's having the last word to find a little bit good to say, even among the bad things.
And that's about all I could say.
And you did well.
And Anne Rowe, as difficult as your job on the Black Border beat is, you don't have to stand in front of friends and family and say it.
No, I've never had to do that, I must say. That would be very hard to do.
Bill,
thank you very much, Neil.
Thanks very much for the call.
Bye.
Appreciate it. Let's see if we can go now to, this is Robert. Robert calling us from Anchorage in Alaska.
Yes, hello, Neil.
Hi.
I have a wife who was being sabotaged by her department chair, whom she went to complain to the dean, and the dean said, this character is the sleaziest character on campus. He died of too much sabbatical. He died young, at around the age of 50. He had 2 years sabbatical. He had a grant to the Cap d'Azur, where he got jaundice from eating clams or oysters. He went on a restorative cruise to the Caribbean in his second year of sabbatical and caught Legionnaire's disease and died. And I really hated this guy. He's the only person I've ever had fantasies of getting a high-powered rifle and offing him. They were just fantasies, of course. So, but my son and his son were best friends, and I thought his wife was a nice person, and she idolized him. So at the memorial service, I was really stumped as to what to say to his wife, whom I liked, about this man whom I hated. So I said, what a man we've lost.
Very clever.
The classic one, of course, I got that idea from Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness, where he sees the widow of Kurtz, or the fiancée of Kurtz, and he says his last words were, your name, which, of course, is a lie, because his last words were, the horror, the horror. And but he protected her by saying your name. And yet, in a way, that it's not a lie. In a way, it's the truth, because the reason Kurtz was out there killing natives was to amass enough money to come back to Belgium and marry his fiancée.
Thanks very much for the call, Robert. That was an incredible call.
Thank you.
Let's see if we can get Steve on the line. And Steve is calling us from Marlton, is that right, in New Jersey?
Yeah, that's correct. It's just outside of Philadelphia. When at former President Richard Nixon's funeral, it was torturous to watch the dignitaries and people that I respect from my side of the political spectrum speak so flowingly, flowery about a man who basically was the opposite of those sentiments that they were expressing. I was wanting to make that comment and throw that in there. Just the torture that it was to watch that.
Mm-hmm. And this is a little bit more up your alley, Anne Rowe, as the compulsion that so many of us have, if you're going to speak at a famous person's funeral, for example, Richard Nixon's, you're going to say something nice.
You've got to say something nice, but I'd have thought, well, I'm sure it's true, in the career of Richard Nixon there was quite a lot that you could credit him for, like the opening to China, for example. Things are a little thin on the ground, perhaps, but you could certainly find in the career of a president plenty of things that were worth praising, I believe. And then you come to the Watergate and all that, of course, you're going to sound rather more condemning. I think, though, it's possible to give even the blackest characters a slightly kind send-off. After all, you can't do anything else at a funeral. You are much freer when you're writing about them in print. The caller who called just now about the chap on the cruise line who had got ill several times and had... It seemed to me that that almost made a comedy of a life, that you could almost make a comic speech out of that one if you wanted to, of him eating the seafood and getting ill and then catching Legionnaire's disease on the cruise, if the family had been up for it, which I suppose is difficult.
Hard to gauge ahead of time.
You could almost have everyone, you know, rocking in the aisles in the church with that story.
Could be a double funeral if you get it wrong.
This is true. But as far as the great statesmen are concerned, I think everyone would have both good and bad sides of them.
Thanks very much for the call, Steve. We're talking with Anne Rowe, the obituaries editor of The Economist, about the difficulties of sometimes writing about less than pleasant people. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And I have to ask you, how far ahead do you work? I mean, for example, there's an assumption, I suspect, that Fidel Castro, just to pick one person, will make news just one more time. Is there something ready to go for Mr.
Castro?
Yes,
we've got something ready to go, but we updated it even this week because the rumors out of Miami that he was actually dead were getting stronger. And we've got the cover done now, too. So we've got about 8 in the store. And I can tell you that's not very many to have because the Daily Telegraph, which is another British newspaper, has about 800 in store. But we only do one a week, so we just keep a little bit ahead of ourselves. But generally we don't, because the climate changes. And if you write an obit of someone, say, a year ahead of when they die, you look at it when they do die, it doesn't ring right. We've got one ready for Mrs. Thatcher. But I can guarantee you, by the time she does die, it won't look right, and we'll have to do it again from scratch.
Let's see if we can get another caller on the line. Let's go to Mitzi. Mitzi's with us from Cleveland.
Hi.
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 I wanted to mention what happened at my father's funeral. My father died when I was in my 50s, and he was a serial philanderer and a hypercritical person. And he lived the last 20 years of his life in a rather small community. So I received a blessing from the Lutheran pastor who gave the eulogy when he began his talk by saying to the assembled congregants, I understand that Art was a difficult person for those of you who knew him and for those of you who were in his family and for those of you who were his children. And I thought that was a terrific gift because someone else was saying this was a hard person to know.
Yeah, somebody else uncovered the elephant in the room.
Yeah, and was willing to say it publicly, and it was a terrific blessing for me as his daughter.
Well, Mitzi, thanks very much. Did you have to rise and speak after that?
No. Mm-mm. He didn't ask us to do that.
All right. Thanks very much. So long.
Bye-bye.
And I wanted to thank you, Anne Rowe, by reading the last paragraph of her dual obituary of Brooke Astor and Leona Helmsley. New York gained hugely from both women. Mrs. Astor gave to the Metropolitan Museum of Art, Rockefeller University, the Bronx Zoo, and her special favorite, the New York Public Library. Mrs. Helmsley gave to New York Presbyterian Hospital, the Weill Cornell Medical College, and her spell in prison, evidently softening her, to poor children and hurricane victims. Both ended sadly, left alone with their dogs and the ghosts of their husbands in dust-draped city apartments or empty summer homes. But in the memory of most New Yorkers, one was a saint and the other a sinner. Richesse oblige. Very nice work, Anne Rowe.
Thank you.
Anne Rowe is the obituaries editor for The Economist magazine. She joins us today from their studios in London. Her latest book is called Being Shelley, A Poet's Search for Himself.
Take away my life from that.